It's Wednesday, December 4th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And this is a week that might be a proving ground for the notion, the rampantly adhered to notion, that it's curtains for the old school legacy mainstream media. I mean, MSNBC might be being sold, certainly being spun off, and CNN's ratings are terrible, and every newspaper other than the New York Times is slowly dying. I'm sure somewhere there are newspapers who might correct me and say, no, we're quickly dying. But it has been a time when the old machinations of media have worked in terms of destroying, or nearly destroying, and this will be the proving grounds, the candidacy of, say, Pete Hegseth. Pete Hegseth has been exposed by such outlets as The New Yorker and NBC, as amplified by MSNBC. New York Times does follow-on reporting, so does The Washington Post, and it all accrues to getting actual factual accounts of his misdeeds while in previous jobs, surfacing them and making his candidacy, his selection to be head of the Department of Defense, much less likely than it was even a couple of weeks ago. And that's almost entirely a lamestream mainstream media function. And I would say you should criticize the mainstream media for lots of things. And in this, they're certainly working hand in glove with interested parties, but that's what they always do. They surface information. If the information isn't inaccurate, then it has an effect, and it could have a huge effect on who gets to lead the Pentagon. Now, will this also play out with the other controversial, shall we say, nominations? Kash Patel? I don't know. He's got a long track record of many, many hours of podcasting, of which I'm diving through the archives. And then there's Tulsi Gabbard. When asked about her confirmation and her past, if not vocalizations of support for Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, then a conspicuous non-support, Bill Hagerty on Meet the Press said this about her past meetings with Assad.
My only understanding about the meetings is they took place sometime in the past.
Yes. Yes, we could tell by the ED at the end of happened. That is a characteristic of many things, many occurrences in the world, all of them that are not currently occurring or have occurred in the future. That's excellent insight, though a very bad dodging of the question. I have no idea if Tulsi Gabbard will have happened to her, what Pete Hegseth is having happened to him. I do not know. I do not have any reason to believe that the salaciousness, which gives it a bit of an angle, the salaciousness of the allegations about Hegseth will in any way show up when it comes to Tulsi Gabbard or Kash Patel. Though maybe with Patel, he wears a scarf too much. Very, very strange, a little bit off-putting. But it is a moment, and we'll see what happens with the Hegseth nomination. We'll see if it's pulled back. But it is a moment to credit the mainstream media for doing what they do well, surfacing information, making people pay attention, and making that information count. On the show today, we shall talk again about Bashar al-Assad, not who he met, Tulsi Gabbard, but what he might be meeting, his doom. And in fact, this will be one of the subjects of conversation with Ben Rhodes, former Barack Obama speechwriter and deputy national security advisor for strategic communications. Ben Rhodes, we widen the aperture to talk about all the problems of the world, or at least the Middle East. Enough problems in that region for really the rest of the world. South Korea would beg to differ, I'm sure. Ben Rhodes, up next. As former Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications in the Obama administration, Ben Rhodes was in the middle of a lot more than just communicating. Or some of his communicating was, say, back-channeling with sources all over the world to achieve a thaw in relations with Cuba, to negotiating peace deals. He was an author of United States foreign policy to a large extent. So my first question to him was about what's going on in Syria. The question being, what is most in America's interest? The perpetuation of the Assad regime or the factions of rebels who have overtaken Aleppo? Who do those rebels represent? Who should the United States be rooting for?
There's no simple answer to that. I wish there was. essentially the factions that have taken over Aleppo are largely Islamist factions, some of which had fairly extremist ties dating back to the time when I was in government, some of which get a lot of support from Turkey, and they're, how they would govern is TBD. You know, we just don't know.
But they're not ISIL. They're not the Taliban. Maybe more like Kurds who we backed in coalitions in the Battle of Mosul, for instance.
Well, it's a little different than that. So then they're the Kurds.
Yeah.
And that's who we've generally backed because they are not Islamic extremists. They do not have ties to terrorist organizations. The Turks think they do because they think that there are Kurds inside of Turkey that have committed acts of terrorism. But by and large, if you've got Assad and he represents kind of Iranian interests and Russian interests inside of Syria, and a really, you know, obviously brutal government that has killed a lot of its own people, then you've got Kurds that are largely backed by the United States, and we kind of still have guys in Syria, and we try to help protect these Kurds who helped us fight and defeat ISIS, and then you've got this kind of mishmash of Sunni Muslim groups, largely, that are in places like Idlib and Aleppo. Those are kind of, it's an oversimplification, but they're kind of, those are the three factions that are kind of battling it out. I actually don't think it's necessarily, we obviously don't want, we don't like Assad. Right now, I think what you kind of want is you just want to get this into some kind of negotiated coexistence between these factions. Mm-hmm. What you don't want is an all-out civil war again, in which is going to cause mass flows of people. It creates openings for extremists like ISIS to regenerate. You kind of want this thing to stop and this to become a version of what, you know, Lebanon used to be before the lid was blown off, but essentially like a negotiated coexistence. So there's stability, so that innocent people aren't getting killed, so that terrorists can't get a foothold. That right now, I think, is probably what the U.S. government is advocating. Because if the groups that overrun Aleppo overrun the whole country, there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty about, okay, who are these people? Are they ready to govern? Will they start massacring the people that they defeated? Will they become the Taliban? Like, we just don't know.
Right,
And so you want to kind of not have this become militarized.
Right. Chaos is almost always worse than stability. Then again, the stability is the stability of Assad, who's almost worse than anyone. My question for you is, would your answer have been different pre-Arab Spring? When I think the idea was, the entrenched powers in the Middle East are so bad, let's try something new. And then I know that, for instance, you were in favor of Hosni Mubarak's removal, and that didn't work out very well, not huge bloodbaths. But I'll go back to my question. Were you informed, and was the promise changed by what we've seen in the last, say, 13 years?
Yeah, I think that the fundamental issue is that there's something unsustainable about this degree of autocracy. And I will always believe that. You know, Bashar al-Assad does not govern in a way that is in the interest of the vast majority of his people. It's just a perpetuation of a kind of corrupt autocratic regime. And there's always going to be a lid on a boiling pot, you know. And it was the same thing was true under Mubarak. The same thing is true under Sisi, the autocrat who governs Egypt now. And so you either have to have some kind of incremental process of improving those circumstances for the people in those countries, or it's going to repeatedly blow, you know. And I after the failure of the Arab Spring, you know, I remember thinking, well, this is just going to happen again in 10, 15, 20 years, unless these places change. They're not. Some of the people in that region kind of understand this. You know, I've been a huge critic of the Gulf countries, of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, of some of the Emiratis. I will say they're aware of this dynamic, and they're at least trying to evolve their economies, not their political systems, so that there's less kind of desperation. Now, it's easier for them to do that when you're sitting on trillions of dollars worth of oil and you can kind of spread that money around. Syria doesn't have that. Egypt doesn't have that. Jordan doesn't have that. What I think is likely to happen in the Trump years that people are not anticipating is, I think it's going to be quite possibly an Arab Spring 2.0 in places like Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, that you can feel the lid beginning to, you know, shake on top of the boiling pot. The conflict in Gaza is going to contribute to that, particularly if there are Palestinians coming into places like Jordan and Egypt. So, unfortunately, I think we may be in for another round of this.
I want to ask you about the Iran nuclear weapons deal. I don't expect you to say anything other than it was worth a try, and I supported it at the time. In retrospect, I'm not so sure, because it did seem vulnerable to the next president, be it Donald Trump or Marco Rubio or whoever, exiting from it. And if you enter any deal, we're a democracy, every 4 years, different presidents might come in, and, you know, it seems like half of our political system is against such a deal. That's a little vulnerable. And I also give more credit now than I do at the time one of the arguments. So one of the arguments was Iran's going to cheat, of course, and then you have to monitor it. That I'll give you. But Iran was using, or did use, a lot of the money to fund Hezbollah and these forces around the world. And that led for more disruption and more chaos and war than would have otherwise happened. So I'll just ask you, with the, in the hindsight of history, could you have done the deal any differently or at all?
Look, I mean, on this one, I fully acknowledge I obviously was a participant. But I actually believe it's been validated. You know, it was, the Iranians were not cheating. They were complying with the deal to the extent that even, you know, in the first Trump term, it took him 2 years to withdraw because his own people, including people like Jim Mattis, who'd not been big supporters of the Iran deal at the time, were like, well, it's working. They're complying. We can't remember. For those who don't follow this that closely, Trump kept trying to get his government to find Iran in noncompliance so he could pull out. And Trump's own government couldn't find them in noncompliance because they
And then he just
compliant.
Did it anyway. Yeah.
And so then he just did it anyway. Here we are. They have accelerated their nuclear program to the worst case scenario that everybody's worried about. They basically have stockpiled enough nuclear material that if they decided to try to go out and build a weapon, they have enough to do it. The region is, you know, we're living at the constant precipice of a war between the United States and Iran, which is something we were trying to prevent because we just didn't think the Americans wanted another war in the Middle East. So to me, the logic of the deal itself clearly holds, because I would prefer them to not have that nuclear material. You know, they were shipping it out. There were inspections there. None of that's there anymore. I, on the money piece, I always took issue with this piece. Iran had the money to fund Hezbollah and these proxies in the aughts. They had it before the Iran deal. They had it after the Iran deal. They have it now. You know, this is not a, I think what people don't realize is this is not vast sums of money to be, you know, sending, you know, shoulder-fired missiles and weapons to Hezbollah, and they create this money. This is in the black market. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps knows how to do business outside of sanctioned industries. You know, and so I think we have this kind of. I mean, here's how I put you, Mike: is you're a data guy. The most sanctioned countries in the world by the United States are Cuba, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia. Is that working? I think we had this sense that sanctions somehow force countries to do what we want. And I actually think it's the opposite. I think the more you sanction these countries, the more you kind of entrench the worst actors. Because the guy that can't figure out how to evade sanctions in Iran is like the small business owner in Tehran. The guys with guns and ships that they, you know, they can smuggle stuff on are going to figure out a way to make money, you know?
Yeah.
And so I never bought the money argument. Now, your best argument is, in our political system, do you do a deal that only has kind of, you know, does not have the support of the other party?
Yeah. And some notable voices within your own, like Chuck Schumer. Yeah.
Yeah. But I on that one, I think, I don't know, like that's a recipe for, never doing anything. I mean, the Republicans made themselves so oppositional to Obama that if we had internalized that logic, it would have been paralyzing to governance because whatever we did, they were going to oppose, you know?
Yeah, it seems to me that there are some types of deal that even if you get a 4 years out of it or 4 years every 8 years, it's still worth it. Paris Accords, League of Nations. And then you have the dynamics of the Iranian deal, which are they sanctions? I mean, they're different from Russian sanctions, which are we once had the free flow of commerce, and then there were interdictions to try to prevent that. With Iran, money was frozen and then released. So it's like sort of a not so many sanctions, but un-de-sanctioning. You know, I was trying to use a double negative. But I think you get all that. It's a hard choice. I don't think it's worked out well. I understand the hope. I think that maybe I'm beginning to think more and more that the optimism and we got to try for something hopeful and non-militaristic was doomed to fail. And often is.
I don't know. But I'd say two things. Nothing was lost. You know, like we got those restrictions on the Iranian program for a few years. We had inspections for a few years. The sanctions relief was not, by the way, it wasn't like it was a check written to Iran. This is how it was always. A bunch of money was frozen and entangled in bank transactions because of our sanctions. The Iranians didn't get the majority of the money because banks were so worried about doing any business with Iran to begin with. So nothing was lost in that time, you know, by doing that deal. And so I don't know, like I find frustrating with the whole discourse around American foreign policy, particularly in this region, is there's a default that there's a scrutiny on the hawkish position is not scrutinized in the same way that, say, the Iran deal scrutinized. Nobody's saying, hey, are these maximum pressure sanctions on Iran working? Because they sure don't seem like they've been behaving the way we want to under maximum pressure sanctions. Like, people say, you know, look at everything that's happened since the Iran deal. It's like, well, look at everything that's happened since the Abraham Accords, you know? We don't say that all that's because of the Abraham Accords, you know. So there's a kind of weird default in national security discussions where America's expected to do the most heavy-handed, hawkish, maximum pressure thing, and there's this intense scrutiny on any deviation from that. But there's not scrutiny on, you know, why do we perpetuate these approaches that don't work?
Yeah, I do think that had your administration just continued on with the sanctions, Iran would be weaker. A weakened Iran would mean less death and chaos in the region. Maybe it would. I also think, well, you tell me, that there was an assumption that, for instance, they're not going to stop funding Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is going to be so strong that they're going to be almost impossible to uproot. And at least some of that has been either disproved or, you know, seriously been put in question.
Well, I guess what I'd say, though, is like people say weaker Iran. They're weaker, but they're still there. There's still an Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and weakness, you know, an implosion of the Iranian state tomorrow. I think the Iranian Revolutionary Guard are the ones that emerge from that because they're the ones with guns, you know?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes, or even right now in Lebanon, you know, Israel's gone in and killed a bunch of Hezbollah leaders in the past, and they regenerate, you know.
Well, nothing like this, though.
Well, maybe nothing on this scale, but let's see what happens. You know, I get my point is that there's this endless cycle, and each time it flares up, it seems to be worse, you know. And so I don't know. I don't know that personally. I don't believe that what's happening in the Middle East right now feels like, and I could be proven wrong. To me, it doesn't feel like the beginning of something better.
Yeah, it doesn't
look
even,
at Syria.
It doesn't. You'd be warranted to say it doesn't actually feel like an end.
But yeah, look at Syria. You were just asking me about a bunch of guys that were once designated as Al Qaeda beginning to take over Syria. Probably because they sense that Hezbollah is weaker. My point is you create these vacuums in the Middle East, you kill a bunch of people, you create a bunch of unrest, you create a bunch of civil strife, and often what comes out of that is worse, you know? And I tend to believe that if we could negotiate outcomes like the Iran deal is trying to do, like obviously, you know, people used to try to do on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, ultimately there'd be more durability to negotiated outcomes than these kind of militarized zero-sum outcomes that you know, tend to generate more conflict and more extremism.
So, Ben, you'd be great guy to talk to. I have to ask you one last question because it always occurs to me, and I, in a few months, haven't had a person who was in your position who actually makes these decisions. So I want to talk about the United States' ability to exert pressure or leverage. And I'll read you the lead from a New York Times, a recent Times story about the truce with Hezbollah. The truce in Lebanon was possible in part because Hezbollah, weakened by months of assassinations and battlefield losses, had lost its leverage at the negotiating table. Then it goes on to say Netanyahu could afford compromise. But this idea of oftentimes what ends a conflict, or at least leads to a ceasefire, is that one side massively loses leverage. Does U.S. administration, when it thinks about how to exert pressure on Israel, does it flat out say, well, our leverage with the Israelis is we give them all these weapons, and after that, the only thing we could do to affect this situation is to pressure them into peace deals or to pressure them to stop fighting? Does an administration ever say, actually, the way to peace might be leverage on the other side and not to hem in the Israelis, who probably won't negotiate if they don't think they're winning by a lot?
Well, I think that's been the default, right? In the sense that our leverage on Israel would be, if we chose to use it, you know, that we give them billions and billions of dollars in weapons. I think every plane that's dropped a bomb on Gaza was a U.S. plane, and not a, you know, flown by Israelis, obviously, but came from us. We also have leverage at the U.N. Like, do we vote for a ceasefire at the U.N. Security Council? And I would argue that Joe Biden has done what you say. I mean, he's exerted no leverage. It doesn't matter what he says or what Biden administration officials say on background. With the exception of a single weapons shipment that was temporarily delayed in the spring, the spigot's been on for weapons. The veto's been used at the UN Security Council. And we've seen essentially the policy of the Israeli government's right wing be predominant. I don't agree with that approach. I think that flattening Gaza and potentially depopulating it, you know, trying to create, you know, make it unlivable so people leave, you know, it may be a short-term military achievement in some fashion, but I just think that's a recipe for a lot more. Not only do I think that's a humanitarian catastrophe for Palestinians, I think it's also a recipe for further long-term, medium and long-term chaos in that region. And I also think I think the U.S. does lose something intangible when the rest of the world looks at us and say, hey, you've been making these arguments about Putin being, you know, the amount of civilian casualties in Ukraine. You guys selectively apply these standards. That's how the rest of the world sees us. With Trump's election, that's certainly how they see us. And I think we're going to miss that. You know, I think we're going to, if we're just another big country that only operates in self-interest, you know, I think we're going to miss the idea that there were supposed to be rules that our team was supposed to follow, you know, because I think we're heading into a world of pure transactionalism. And I don't feel optimistic about what that world's going to feel like.
Ben Rhodes was Deputy National Security Advisor under President Barack Obama. We've been talking to him about his recent Times essay. I study guys like Trump. There's a reason they keep winning. Listen to him on the Pod Save the World podcast. And thanks very much. It was an interesting conversation.
Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it. It's great talking to you.
And now the spiel. Let us talk about Aleppo and Syria. One of the worst bastards in the history of the world, Bashar al-Assad, is on the ropes. So that's good, right? Well, as you heard Ben Rhodes say, maybe not. Chaos, generally worse than order, even, I suppose, a dictatorial, oppressive order. And then there is the question of these rebels. Just who are these rebels? What motivates them? What's their deal, man? NPR describes them this way.
The group behind these developments has held a consequential but checkered role in the country's long-running civil war.
Oh, they're the checkered rebels. Why'd we have to get the checkered rebels? I thought we'd be getting rebels who are shortlisted for Nobel Peace Prizes or maybe the Amnesty International Human Rights Watch Person of the Year type rebels. We couldn't get the Annie E. Casey Foundation for the Well-Being of American Children and Youth type rebel. That would be a nice rebel. But no, no, we could not. Those pacifist, not shooting gun effectively type rebels, those are the bad rebels. In fact, they're not even so successful as to reach the status of rebels. We just usually call them, there's another word for those kind of rebels, we call them victims or the dead. They're referenced in such phrases as they are among the dead. But when you get to the actually winning battle type rebels, you often have a large overlap with unsavory sorts. But I know you get it. You've experienced gunfire.
And a warning, you will hear gunfire at the top of this piece.
Or not, as warned about at the top of the piece. By the way, and this isn't my main point, but that stuck out of me, like a bayonet. Sorry, trigger warning, could be a bayonet. I was wondering, how bad must the gunfire be that NPR had to tell us about it before they played it? Before they played that literal trigger warning, here is the whole amount of gunfire heard in that report.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or the Organization for the Liberation of Greater Syria, swept down this week from its strongholds in the country's northwest countryside, meeting little resistance. Its forces surprised many when they seized control of Aleppo, the country's second-largest city, crushing government forces.
So, I'm not a bad man. I'm not the Bashar al-Assad of this situation. I'm not unsympathetic to the veteran who was traumatized by gunfire and appreciates the warning so he could change the radio station before they get to the gunfire. I get all that. But on the other hand, there is a lot of research that shows trigger warnings, especially the non-literal ones, actually inspire more dread than anything else, and that they worsen whatever ill effect one might otherwise experience just actually hearing the thing. So I say, maybe bypass the warning, get a slight criticism. Someone's going to write in for not having the warning, but actually, in real life, traumatize fewer listeners. That's the bold choice. You get less plaudits for it. I get it, and I get that I am an imperfect spokesman on this in that I got to have it both ways, right? I played NPR giving you the warning, which I guess I should have warned you about if you found that offensive. So, these checkered rebels, they were, in fact, we do have to say, yes, they knew Al-Qaeda. They were on a first-name basis with Al-Qaeda. But that was when Al-Qaeda was the only game in town. You know, the Mujahideen become the Taliban, so they were once U.S. allies when they were the only gang in town. Now, the Taliban, the ex-Mujahideen, these current Syrian rebels, they're not like ISIS. They're not like Al-Qaeda. They're not prioritizing the return of the caliphate. They just want Assad out, as do I. If any affiliation with a classic enemy of the United States, such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS, if any of that is a total disqualification for a rebel group, well, then who would the rebel groups ever be? They'd only be the Kurds, the Peshmerga, who I love, but Turkey doesn't. The real badass Assad rebels are the Al-Nusra Front. They're the front for the liberation of the Levant, they call themselves. They're not former allies of Al-Qaeda. They're current allies of Al-Qaeda. They saw what Al-Qaeda was putting down, and they picked it up in a big way. They, like Al-Qaeda, they're Salafi jihadists. Those are the worst kind of jihadists. They're just like ISIS, but maybe with a lighter touch, if it can be believed. I know how it works in international affairs with the American foreign policy establishment. I know the temptation, if you don't want to think of yourself or get yourself called a raging hawk, is to say these are all bad choices and then not make one. Back no one. Fear unintended consequences. Learn the history of past entanglements. These don't sound like bad practices, do they? It sounds like I'm denigrating these habits of mine, but shouldn't we learn the history of past entanglements? Okay, I would not start shipping weapons to anyone soon, but I hope the U.S. has a reasoned and informed theory about what outcome is best for U.S. interests, and I hope that, to some extent, guides our choices. And since the incoming administration is one I trust far less to correctly make those choices, I don't think it would be a bad thing for the current administration or their allies outside of government to engage in some public diplomacy indicating where American interests actually lie. It's tempting. It's probably wisely risk-averse for the foreign policy establishment to start pushing their chips in the middle of the table. But to just say, that it's God's will, or whatever happens, happens, or let's trust Allah, it doesn't seem like the most reasonable posture of the world's one great superpower. Because now Russia is weakened, Iran is battered, and al-Assad might fall. I can't demand to know what comes next, but perhaps an examination of the U.S.'s interest would add some clarity to the admittedly unknown. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. We have interning from Leo Baum, Michelle Pesca, CBSO of Peachfish Productions, Upuru Jipuru, Jupuru. Thanks for listening.